Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome to Talking Pictures with Paul Booth. Thank you for joining me for episode number 3. I'm really, really excited about today because today's guest is going to talk to us about the visual effects side of filmmaking. Our last two episodes, we had live-action directors, and we want to thank Miles and Michael for coming on. Before I get the show underway, I have to say thanks to my friend Alexa Foreman at Turner Classic Movies, who gave us this wonderful title, Talking Pictures. I'm going to throw out some movie recommendations for you before we get our guest on. Josh and I are fellow alumni of the Vancouver Film School, so I'm really excited about today. I'm going to give you guys a Netflix recommendation, a find a movie at your local library recommendation for those of you that still like DVDs, and I'm going to recommend something on Turner Classic Movies that you need to check out this week. First of all, for Netflix, Stand By Me, they just put it up on streaming. I highly recommend that film, directed by Rob Reiner, one of the great performances and ensemble acting by children, but of course River Phoenix, that was his really tour de force performance. Everyone, if you have not seen it, check it out. For those of you that have seen it, revisit it. The other one for the library film is Network, which is by the great Sidney Lumet. I just want to make sure, are you with us, Josh?
I am, yeah. How are you,
okay.
Paul?
Cool, good. Thank you for joining us. I'm just going through the last bit of recommendation here. Network, Sidney Lumet's masterpiece. Of course, anything Lumet does is a masterpiece in my opinion, but I'm the most biased person on the planet when it comes to Lumet. And the last thing I want to let you guys know, that playing this Saturday night on Turner Classic Movies at 9:30 Pacific time is Badlands with Martin Sheen, which is a great just kind of road movie. I don't want to spoil it too much. You will trip how much Charlie Sheen looks like his dad. You'll think you're watching a Charlie Sheen movie. So take those recommendations, enjoy them, have a great movie week. And now our guest is Josh Lang, who's joining us on the air. Thank you for joining us, Josh.
Hello.
And Josh, just to tell you a little bit about him here before we get into what he has to tell us about, is a character animator, and previs artist who's worked on such films as The Avengers, Marvel's The Avengers, Divergent, Godzilla, X-Men Days of Future Past, and a few upcoming blockbusters that he's going to tell us about today, so you definitely want to stay tuned as we go through this. So Josh, for those that don't know, I know I didn't know until I knew you, if you could tell us maybe a little bit about what a previs artist does and what you do, and if you have a film that you liked working on.
Sure, absolutely. It's definitely far from a household name at this point, but previs has been around for decades. It's come into light more recently, though, because the need for it has grown as movies get more grand and spectacle, as production budgets shorten. And so what's happened over recent years is there have been more specialists in the previs field, and it's considered part of the art department most times, I would say, but it does greatly involve visual effects. And so what the previs department does is work with the director very tightly early on to help solve big problems as they come up early, so that you're not dealing with logistical problems on the shoot or even later in post-production. So we're basically creating a rough version of the film in the computer. It's a rough animation, something not even at the level of a video game cinematic, I would say. And so as the director, you know, gives new notes and gives new direction for how he wants the film to evolve, we're doing that very fast on the fly and also very inexpensively relative to changing these things later on.
I see. So now when you were talking about a problem being solved, is there something that you could tell us without mentioning the movie, because I know you work in a very kind of, it's not secretive, but Josh works on very big films that have a secrecy to them before they're released. But is there something that you could explain to us that's kind of like when you said it could possibly solve a problem early on?
Sure. So maybe a good example would be you're shooting in a specific location and you know this early on, but at the same time you haven't actually visited it with cameras, with cranes, and you need to know if the shots that you have in your mind are going to logistically work once you get to the location. So you'll have your location scout give details, you know, room layouts, sizes, that kind of thing. And then you've got maybe your storyboards that have certain pictures that might use certain lenses to get those compositions. So what would be done then is you'd go into the computer with the previs guys, and they would use specific camera lenses, and through the computer that can give a much more accurate sense of where the camera can be placed within your real live location. And so if you think, oh, well, I think I'm going to put a camera this high up with this lens and I'll get this look, you know, you might have to make some adjustments once you get a better sense of if that's going to really work. And Previs is excellent for that because we're working with accurate scale. You know, the actors' heights are known, and we have models that are that size relative to the environment, and all those pieces can come together in the computer and give a very accurate sense of what's possible and what would be a lot of work to make possible. And then from those revelations, the director can make changes before he even really starts shooting, which is something that, you know, prior to a few decades ago was impossible.
Oh, right. I mean, and that sounds very interesting. It almost sounds like it gives you a great blueprint, but then maybe takes away from spur-of-the-moment stuff. But I guess with some of these movies, like, I'm sure you were quite excited to work on The Avengers. I mean, that was such a massive budget movie. Was there a favorite scene or sequence that you were a part of that you could tell us about?
Sure, absolutely. With The Avengers, for me, a majority of where the previs work came in handy was in the third act, where you've got the massive Manhattan battle scene. You've got action happening on the ground level, in the air. It's all got to make sense. The audience has to have a good, grounded sense of where certain events are happening. You've got to follow traditional filmmaking rules like the 180 rule, which generally you don't want to break if you don't have to. And so these are massive decisions, and it requires a great understanding of practical filmmaking to pull off for such a grand spectacle that you're achieving through all these different, you know, specialists that work on the film. And so through the previs, we were able to use the storyboards as a starting point, and then, of course, you know, transition those into a more accurate realization of how those storyboards set up the action. And as you work on the movie and you realize certain things need to be changed, or maybe a shot that you were imagining was going to be 2 seconds long, now it has to be 5 seconds long, or it needs to involve this composition, you know, these decisions can be made very fast with a quick turnaround on the previs side, and as a result, you get a much more accurate picture.
Now, just something that never dawned on me till now was how long was it between when you did the previs work of them fighting in Manhattan when they actually shot that? Like, what's the turnaround time for a previs shot versus when they might be shooting?
Sure. Typically, it could be around a year. You know, at least that much time, ideally, because you do want to have a lot of advance notice so that the notes that you can provide through the previs can be implemented early on and affect all the other decisions that would be, you know, influenced by that down the river there, I guess. And so, as much time as possible, but typically maybe it's a year or so. You know, we're working on previs generally around the time that casting is going on. And, you know, relative to the film's production, that's when you can imagine all that is taking place. Although previs will last much later than after the casting period.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know it was that far advanced. That's interesting. I have to take a little break here to plug and mention a film that a friend of mine, Miles Doliak, has. For you listeners on the East Coast, or if you have friends in New York, or if you're in New York, please let him know. His film is called The Historian. Again, that's The Historian, and it stars William Sadler, which we all know from Shawshank Redemption. He plays Haywood, and he's the main terrorist in Die Hard 2. It's coming to the Quad Cinemas in The Village, again, in New York City, The Village. and that's going to be starting November 28th. Very rare for indie films to have a theatrical run these days, so that kind of tells you the quality of the film. But now back to talking with Josh. I know I'm biased towards this film because I just loved it and had no expectations, and I know I have a lot of friends who were a big fan of it, but I'd love to hear what you could tell us about Divergent, or a specific sequence that was challenging for you or that you really learned from.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. With Divergent, you know, to contrast it from Avengers really briefly, there's a different set of pressure that's put on the filmmakers at that point, because while with the Avengers, the characters that you're working with were extremely known throughout the world, and the pressure to have an excellent finale, I guess, to the first phase of the Marvel movies, you know, required that we really had to make sure we delivered. With Divergent, you're trying to set up a new franchise, so it's something that's less familiar to audiences, and your budget obviously isn't, you know, close to what the Avengers is. So you've got to make sure that you're giving the most bang for the buck as you're trying to think of creative ways to use visual effects in the movie. And so, you know, one of the sequences that I really like doing was the mirror room sequence, where the Triss character has to navigate through this, you know, sort of surreal mirrored room where certain things are changing in front of her eyes, and she's not quite sure what to expect next, even though it's in a very simple set, you know, a room with mirrors on every wall. And because you've got all these reflections going, you know, into infinity around her, you can't practically shoot it with the film crew because you would see the camera reflected in the mirrors. So that all had to be done digitally. And essentially how it was done was you had multiple cameras shooting the action of Shailene Woodley walking around and saying her lines, and you had cameras positioned around her filming it all simultaneously. And so the footage that was created from each camera angle was then used as the reflection from different points on that mirror around her.
Ah, interesting. That scene made me think of, for you classic film lovers that have seen Bruce Lee's Enter the Dragon.
Yeah,
that infamous scene when he enters the room of mirrors. And now that you explain that, it makes me wonder how they even did it in the Bruce Lee movie, especially with what technology and film was, and there certainly wasn't computers or a whole set of teams choreographing Bruce Lee's action advance.
Yeah, as a result, I think the amount of mirrors that you saw at any one time was, you know, far reduced from the numbers of mirrors in Divergent. And so, you know, you're able to pull off reflections in a mirrored room if each mirror is pointed away from the film crew who's shooting it. But in Divergent, like I say, that's pretty much impossible because it's the next level up of trying to achieve a massive amount of mirrors in a sequence.
Well, I know another sequence in Divergent that I remember being really intrigued by what you guys pulled off effects-wise was when they're being chased by the dogs and jumping up on the L train. And for those of you that haven't been to Chicago or haven't seen an L train, obviously it was a really perfect rendition. But I found myself, it was interesting to see the way a computer-generated dog could make me scared. And so is there any kind of challenges in you guys portraying emotions in an animal if you're putting it on CGI, or is it just kind of the
Sure.
tone of the whole scene? Or
Yeah. So when certain emotional reactions that you're trying to get out of the audience are dependent on the actions of an animal, obviously it's a very risky gamble because it can be hard to get specific reactions from an animal, even though there are very trained people who've handled that sort of thing for, you know, years and years in the Hollywood system. And so what we try to do now with computer technology is completely create CG animals and get, you know, much more dialed-in performances out of them. So, you know, in the mirrored sequence that I mentioned before, there was a German Shepherd that was a real German Shepherd. And so that animal's, you know, performing what he needs to do. And as a result, he's used in a very specific way in that sequence so that the director is using it exactly how he means to. It's not just some, you know, random performance. It's something that they can use a highly trained dog to pull off. And just quickly to go back to what you were mentioning about Chicago, that was one of the nice things about Divergent was it was one of those films that, you know, these days this is not as common as you might expect, but it was shot in the city where it was meant to take place. So it was a Chicago setting in the book, and also the movie itself was shot in Chicago, so it benefited from accurate locations. And, you know, while we did do digital L trains at times, by and large, what you see in that movie is Chicago itself.
Well, plus, you know, obviously without being too personal, you had experience with Chicago, so that must have really helped your your work.
Yeah, I lived there for 3 years.
Yeah. So, I mean, I remember from the opening shot, I mean, I've only been to Chicago a few times, but just the opening shot to me, I thought if this is, you know, they're either shooting here or if this is CGI, then we're in a whole new realm, because just that skyline is so, for those of, if you haven't been to Chicago, go to Chicago, but for those of you that have been, you know, it's a very distinct skyline, much like New York City or I would say Los Angeles, but sometimes you can't see downtown because of smog. But yeah, thank you for going into that Divergent stuff, because I know that's what I've been, that's been my favorite film on your list. Is there anything that you have currently working on or that's going to be coming out soon that you can tell us about?
Sure, yeah. Well, we just finished up post-production on Night at the Museum 3 over at Fox, and so that was a long project that was a lot of fun to do, and so I'm very much looking forward to seeing how that all comes out when it's all said and done this December. And then as far as another thing that I could mention, on Saturday, the trailer launched for Furious 7, the latest Fast and Furious movie that I worked on last year, and the shots in it look great. I'm really excited about that one, and obviously the tone of it, it took a lot of focus and planning and just a lot of deliberation over how exactly to get that movie done right after the passing of the late Paul Walker, which was very sad and a big shock to production as they were trying to make that movie. So they basically used every trick in the book for VFX and just wanted to get that movie done right. And I think it's going to be a great movie when it comes out, and certainly one that people will be very interested to see how everything wrapped up.
Well, it's kind of interesting, not interesting like when we're interested in a museum, but to think that you're a part of these basically last two movies of, you know, two great actors. I mean, Robin Williams, I mean, I'm sure there's other stuff. They said he was shooting. I'm sure, you know, we know studios will move around release dates and you know, try to land stuff on the anniversary of his death. Again, I want to say before I proceed with this point, all the opinions of the show are mine, or if what Josh says are his, they don't reflect who Josh works for, who I work with, or anyone. So I want to make that clear to everyone, all the listeners. So with this Robin Williams thing, it's going to be very interesting to see how that plays into the release, what they did with him. And then, of course, Paul Walker. I know there was all those wonderful internet rumors saying the movie wasn't going to be made and they were going to scrap it, and then to proceed with it is pretty cool. I've always enjoyed, literally at each end of this spectrum, I've either liked or completely hated when I see one of those films. And none of them can get me in between. So I'm really intrigued by the seventh one. I mean, we're all going to be intrigued by the fact that Paul Walker passed during production, and so it's going to kind of have that specialness to it. So is there a feeling for you, not that you're obviously not thankful that Paul Walker or Robin Williams passed away, but that you kind of get to be a part of film history?
Well, I think what I can say on that is it definitely, it's a much more powerful experience to be a part of that in any way. I'm obviously, I'm in a much smaller role than the actors, the above-the-line creatives who worked very closely with Robin and with Paul. But from what my vantage point shows, it's a much more moving project to be on as a result. And in both cases, as it's clear, there were projects that were sequels, you know, down the line in two successful franchises. And when you've got that much of a close-knit team and crew who've been with each other for movie after movie, the bond is very close. And even though I'm on the outside of that looking in, it definitely came through in the footage that we saw. And I think in both cases, the crews were extremely respectful and extremely thoughtful about how to pay homage and be extremely respectful of the lives both people led, and make sure that the movies that, you know, they'll be in for, in Paul Walker's case, I believe the last time, and for Robbins, one of his last few releases, to make sure that they're finished right and like I say, with respect.
Yeah, because I noticed here, just I had never, you know, it's interesting that you've had the contrast of working on a well-known franchise like the Avengers, and that we're, like you're saying, where either everyone at least knows who Hulk is. People who aren't comic book fans, like myself, of course, know Iron Man. I don't know all the backstories and side stories, and sometimes the amount of sequels and prequels make my head spin. But another thing just that I wanted to ask you about before I want to get into what I ask guests about what they're watching is Godzilla. As much as that wasn't a franchise or trying to, I mean, obviously there's going to be a sequel, so it's, I think we all know the opening weekend instantly meant sequel, but that you were kind of doing something that was, everyone has the Godzilla they grew up with, so now you get to see this generation's Godzilla.
Yeah, speaking of
do you have a special thing to be a part of. Yeah, I mean, because I know when, like, I saw it with my dad, and he remembers growing up with the, like, where Godzilla was probably just a tall guy in a suit, and he never imagined that, you know, Godzilla would be taller than the Transamerica building in San Francisco and would be breaking up the Bay Bridge. So to him, that was, like, he was thoroughly amazed. Like, he, you know, I remember him telling me when we walked out, he's like, I didn't think I would live long enough to see movies be this. That mm-hmm. Godzilla that has, we look back and we think it's cheesy or we laugh, but that he was like, that Godzilla, for some weird reason, was just as scary when he cut to him as a kid, has this new Godzilla that I couldn't imagine what it would do for kids seeing it. I'm not too sure. I didn't pay attention if it had a big kid audience, because I think it was PG-13. I might be wrong.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that you've kind of had this contrast of being in, you know, something where there's going to be sequels and you kind of know it, or you're already far into the sequels like X-Men. So with that, I'm always intrigued by, like, what my guests are, like, what they're watching or what they're drawing inspiration from or what they're into at the moment that's kind of fueling
sure.
their creative process.
Yeah, I guess for me, you know, like you, I've just been a huge movie fan for a very long time, as far as I can remember. And with that, I'm always watching any number of different types of films. And obviously, you go through phases where you kind of, you get into a groove of liking a certain type of movie, and then you want to see something similar to that next. And so I went through, you know, film noir phase fairly recently, and with working at Fox, watched a lot of classic Fox films for a while. And just in generally speaking, though, what I'm trying to watch now are Oscar-winning films, other films of note that relate to Best Picture, Best Visual Effects, of course, because that's very related to what I work on, and Best Cinematography, which also is something that we have to keep in mind as previous people, because we are trying to establish the look of a movie through the shots and compositions, and so that's directly related to what we do. So I think a good individual movie that I could mention would be the 1940 version of Thief of Baghdad, which I watched recently. It's, you know, not exactly on the tip of everyone's tongue, but it was something that I really got a lot out of going back to and finding it to watch. It's a very influential movie on the first wave of, you know, new digital effects people like Dennis Muren over at ILM. And it was also very influential on Francis Ford Coppola and the filmmakers like Martin Scorsese and his generation. And one of the interesting things about it that makes it kind of interesting for visual effects fans is it was, I think, the first example of the blue screen effect being used on a major motion picture. And so there's this a couple of interesting shots in it where the blue screen effect is used, where a man is riding a horse in the sky. And of course, back then they didn't have the technology able to remove a lot of the glowing blue border around the man and the horse. But it was still clear enough to the audience that, okay, this man is trying to ride this horse in the sky that previously you couldn't replicate at all. So watching that movie was a lot of fun.
And was that and for those of you that don't know, Dennis Muren is Star Wars, Jurassic Park. He's the, he's the guru of innovation and changing things. I wanted to
He won well over 10 Academy Awards for visual effects supervisor, and extremely influential.
Yeah, for those of you out there, that's one of the reasons why I wanted to bring Josh on the show, was because we have these filmmakers like Dennis Muren or sound. There's Walter Murch for Apocalypse Now, and he's from the classmate of George Lucas and the great cinematographer Caleb Deschanel, who shot The Patriot with Heath Ledger and Mel Gibson. And these filmmakers literally, changed the way we hear movies or changed the way we watch movies. And you ask five people who they are and they don't know. But I know just the culture that we're in, and I don't want to get into the political debate of it. So I wanted to kind of bring someone on that could explain, and so we can kind of look and have a better appreciation for what we're watching on the screen, and know that as much as a film, is definitely, X-Men Days of Future Past, if that was, if Bryan Singer was producing or directing, yes, it is their film decision-making, but that there's a lot of people that go into it. And when you guys see movies on the screen, there's a reason why there's hundreds, if not now thousands, of names. And I just know now because I sit and watch the credits to see Josh's name when I go to films. And it just amazes me that it's like, I didn't even know there was this many people that could fit on a studio lot or in an office. For those of you that don't know, I mean, Godzilla had Vancouver, Hawaii, and Los Angeles units. And I knew people in all three units. It was pretty crazy to see friends' names in the credits from all three areas. But just to know that that's the scope of what film is becoming, that now that you can digitize Hawaii or you can digitize somewhere else or certain shots, which that airport in Hawaii, for everyone that knows, that was a Vancouver airport doubling as Honolulu, because anyone who saw Godzilla that's from Hawaii knows there's no train at Honolulu Airport. So as soon as I saw that tram train, I was like, this isn't Honolulu. So that was
you ruined the illusion for me, Paul.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. In case you guys didn't miss in that big fake lizard that was running around, and I hate to break it for you that it was the wrong airport. I wanted to just tell us one more time the title of that movie, because definitely if it had Scorsese and Coppola talking about it, it is a must-see essential, and that was...
Yeah, so that's The Thief of Baghdad. There are actually two versions of it. There was an earlier version that Douglas Fairbanks created, but this is the one that was made in 1940. It's a color film, and actually for DVD fans, there's a terrific commentary on it, involving Francis Ford Coppola and Martin Scorsese on the Criterion, I think. I don't think the regular one would have that, but it's definitely worth digging up if you're a big fan of filmmakers themselves in addition to just classic movies. Obviously, it doesn't, in some ways, stand the test of time compared to today's effects, but if you keep in mind just the age when it was coming out, and you can kind of distance yourself a bit from that and not be so... focused on today's standards of filmmaking, I think it would be a fun thing to watch.
Yes, Severin, you have to put definitely the context is another reason why is that I'm going to venture through with this show, as we have, for you new listeners, as we're going to have actors and writers, directors, producers, crew people, which seldom shows have on. is to give people this kind of, you know, like what I had mentioned, network in the beginning of the top of the show. Network is this great movie that was made in 1976. It won the Best Actor, Best Actress, and Best Supporting Actress Oscar. It had multiple nominees in some of the categories. It won Best Screenplay, but it lost Best Picture to Rocky. And this movie, Network, was basically built on the premise of what if a news channel decided to start making the news more entertainment instead of the truth. And so This movie is very ahead of its time. You can watch it and think, okay, 1976, Sidney Lumet never cared about the rules. He never cared about what anyone thought about him. Every filmmaker loves Sidney Lumet. For those of you that are saying Sidney Lumet, who he made Dog Day Afternoon, he made Serpico, 12 Angry Men would probably be the one that almost any filmgoer knows. But
Prince of the
movie
City.
Network, you got to check out, especially since Josh mentioned Criterion. The two discs has like a 90-minute documentary making of, has a commentary, has a one-hour interview with Sidney Lumet that was filmed, I think it was 2 years before he passed. This guy was just a master. So we got to, like, I think I'm glad that you mentioned context, because if you look at this movie in the 70s, you know, corporations didn't own everything, and there wasn't, the news was the news. The news wasn't because what the car company wanted the news to be. So it's a really intriguing film. And also for Network, for you trivia fans out there, first movie for the guy who won Best Actor, Peter Finch, won the Oscar, and he had died a few weeks before. And, of course, Heath Ledger passed away back in 2008 and won the Oscar the following year for his portrayal of the Joker. And because I like to always take trivia as far as I can, they were both from Australia. So that's a little bit of my movie nerddom and shows you how many pointless facts I have in my head.
Can I point out one thing, too, while
the subject
is on Sidney Lumet? Yeah, I just wanted to quickly mention as well, for those interested in filmmaking itself, there is that terrific book that you recommended to me that I finished not too long ago, so it's been on my mind, but Sidney Lumet's Making Movies, fantastic book. Definitely recommend it for anybody to check out that's interested in the filmmaking process back when he was cranking out terrific films. So thanks again for recommending that.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because our guest last week mentioned that book.
Yeah.
So for all you listeners.
We got a streak going. We got a streak of mentioning that book.
Yeah, that tells you all you need to know of two guests that don't know each other and have never met are mentioning a book. Then that's really all you need to know. The last guest and I actually kind of made a joke that for filmmakers, for all you listeners, don't get all religious on me, but we kind of joked that it would be like if there was a filmmaking Bible, if you kind of had to have that book that was by your bedside, that it would be Sidney Lumet's Making Movies, because it just breaks everything down, tells you what you need to know. He doesn't toot his own horn. He doesn't brag about what he knows or who he's met or whatever, and it's just an incredible book, so I'm glad that you brought that up. So unless there's anything else you wanted to add, Josh, about what you do, we're coming up on our wrap-up time, but we wanted to thank you for calling in and sharing your stories with us.
Absolutely.
We appreciate it. Thank you so much. Oh, yes, definitely, definitely. And we'd love to, in the future, the next thing that you work on, or if you'd like to come on and give a, you know, let people know about something that's coming out, we can do that. Just so everyone knows, Josh is in a part of the business that's very secretive, and he's not usually allowed to talk about what he works on. So it's kind of funny because I've known him for so many years, and he can never tell me what he's working on. So I can never really say congratulations on or... So we're always kind of stuck in this one-sided, like I can say what I'm doing, but he can just say, oh, I went to work today. So we want to let people know that it was a real privilege today to have someone here that can explain to us these movies and talk a little bit about the stuff of, you know, of what's coming up and the new blockbusters and the ones to kind of revisit and kind of, you know, appreciate and not just look past as what's coming out next and kind of view film as beginning, middle, and end, not just, you know, what can we see tomorrow and forget about yesterday. So,
absolutely.
So thank you so much.
It's easier
Josh,
to talk about him a bit once you have a trailer out in theaters. That's the one thing that helps get the conversation going.
Oh no, that's good. I mean, that was great timing. I'm glad because I was really looking forward to seeing what they were going to do with I guess Furious 7. It would be intriguing to know why they took the title Fast out of it. But I'm sure obvious reasons. But yeah, again, it was great having you on. And anytime you want to come back, let us know. We're probably going to, for you listeners too, we're going to be having episodes where people can call in and ask questions of the guests within reason. And also where we're going to kind of have an episode that we're working on where we can kind of have like a movie talking roundtable. So if you want to kind of call in and you have something you wanted to say about, say, Sidney Lumet, you can call in and spend 2 or 3 minutes discussing Sidney Lumet. So I want to let you know that. So, Josh, you can also, in the future, if you want to call in as a listener, you know, feel free.
Great. Thank you.
Excellent. Well, thank you for your time, and I'm going to wrap the show now. I want to thank everyone again for today's show, and we appreciated Josh calling in, and it's been great having the response we've had to episodes 1 and 2. I cannot thank you guys enough. Please keep telling your friends if they love movies, even if they just like movies or if they're just interested in learning more. This is the place to enjoy film and appreciate film. It's not about my ego or the guest's ego or any ego. So, again, have a great night. Thank you for joining me on Talking Pictures with Paul Booth. And look forward to seeing you next time. Episode 4 will be on November 5th. Guest to be announced. Maybe you should just tune in to find out and see who it is. I'll have some kind of great surprise for you. Aloha.